which had been sent to me for review in the Journal of Reform Judaism. And one of the important early figures in the field of modern Hebrew literature, Abraham Maffu. The author was Dr. David Patterson, our guest of this morning. And he was and remained for many years simply a man of great critical acumen and literary skill whose book I had read and enjoyed. And then, a few years ago, some of you may remember, we took a trip to England, to Jewish England. And those of us who were on that trip had the opportunity to go to Oxford and to visit while we were there with Dr. Patterson, who had been kind enough to invite us to visit the manor house of the Postgraduate Center for Hebrew. The Book of Job explores and dramatizes the theme of unmerited suffering. Job, as you recall, is an elderly man who has been a model citizen, a man of quality, character, all of his life. And towards the end of his life, he is suddenly afflicted with the tortures of the damned. They are unmerited. And he cries out against his fate. And because included in his suffering has been the death of his children, comforters, three elderly friends come to visit him. They come out of affection, they come out of sympathy, they come out of respect, and they come also to voice the commonplace justifications, explanations of God's ways to man. Suffering, they tell Job, takes place because we are being tried, tested, or takes place in order to humanize us, to remind us of the suffering that most people undergo and endure throughout their lives. Suffering, they say, is part of God's plan. And they also tell Job that if he suffers, it is because somehow he has sinned, even though he is blind to that sin. Job throughout protests his innocence and claims that whatever he may have done, if he had in fact been sinful, the suffering is all out of proportion to whatever minor infraction of some formal rule he might have performed. Now that's the Book of Job as it's widely understood. But any great classic text, any text which has survived, raises a number of themes. And one of the little noticed but very important themes in the Book of Job is a challenge to the veneration of age, which permeated the ancient world and which underlies so much of the biblical world. There was no public order in the ancient world. Every tribe had to be a self-sufficient unit. It had to provide for its own economic well-being, it had to provide its own food, it had to make for its own defense, it had to take care of justice. And the great danger in the ancient world was if a tribe would split up when there were competing sheikhs or elders who each wanted the ultimate authority. And these battles were suicidal for the group. And so the culture reinforced the idea that there was an absolute standard for authority, and that standard was age. No one could argue who was the elder among the chiefs. And so the standard of age led to the reverence of age. And throughout the Torah, throughout the Bible, one finds in the proverbial wisdom and elsewhere admonitions of the kind, you know, rise up before the hoary head, honor the face of the old man. And one of these conventional phrases is repeated several times in the dialogues between the comforters and Job. They're all old men, after all. Orech yamim tevuna, with the aged is wisdom, in length of days lies understanding. And one of the little noticed features of the Book of Job is that after there have been three cycles of dialogues between Job and his three elderly comforters, A young man suddenly appears on the scene, a man named Elihu. And Elihu is a good deal the younger of all of the others. And he is angry at the comforters because he feels that they have not properly responded to Job. And he begins his soliloquy in this way. I am young. I thought that age should speak, that old men, but old men I have discovered are not always wise, and the aged do not always understand. Now this recognition that age is often a second childhood, that age ought not to command automatic deference, we take as a commonplace. There's nothing radical, quite the contrary. Ours is a time when the youth is rather venerated. It is not only full of promise, but it is the age of activity, the age when the mind and the body are at their keenest. But in the ancient world, this was a radical statement indeed, and one which undermined a good bit of the ethical teachings on which the Torah is based. Today we take for granted Disraeli's lovely little remark that when a man has come to his anecdotage, it is time for him to retire from the world. But in that world, when a man came into his age, he came into authority. And so their world in many ways was different in form and spirit than ours. Now all this is by way of a rather long-winded, should I say, introduction to a man who on the 11th of June of this year will celebrate his 100th birthday. Mordecai Kaplan was born on June 11th, 1881, in a little town, a little Jewish town in Lithuania. And he is a living proof in many ways that the Bible, the Torah, though we dispute its automatic deference for age, was not so wrong in saying that with age there is wisdom, and in length of years there can be understanding. Because though he will be 100, and though his body is now much frailer than it once was, he continues to write every year, still during the entire decade of his 90s, an essay or two of size and significance has appeared from his pen. And I don't know about you, but I'm of the belief that anybody who has found the secret of remaining strong and able and capable and creative until the age of 100 deserves to be listened to. Whether you agree with his ideas or not, there's always something that might be of benefit to all of us. And I think the best way to introduce Kaplan to you is to tell you very briefly that he was born in Lithuania. He came as a child around 1890 to the United States. He comes out of the intense Jewish world of Eastern Europe, and he remains within that world throughout his life. Because the world as his is the world of New York Jewry, the world of the East Side that moves slowly uptown, the world which was steeped in Jewish culture, the world which came to the United States long after the 19th century Western European immigration had taken place and long after Reform Judaism had established itself as the dominant element, the dominant theme in American society. By 1890, when Kaplan, as a child of nine, appears in these shores, nearly 90% of the congregations in the United States are Reform. And much of the significance of Kaplan's work is that he was dissatisfied not so much with the ideology of Reform as with the fact that Reform had put Judaism on a diet. It had reduced Judaism from a culture to a religion. And much of what he said can be summarized very briefly. That Judaism is not simply a congregation, that is, worship and religious education for the young. It is not simply lighting a few lights occasionally on a Sabbath night or having an annual Seder in the home. It is a civilization, a religious civilization, a civilization which must include theater and music and language and art and literature, and all the elements which go into making any high culture. That if Judaism is allowed to remain in the American diaspora as simply a religion, that is simply that which happens in the synagogue and occasionally in the home, it will shrivel. and die from anemia, because that's not what Judaism is, simply a redeeming gospel. Judaism is a much broader phenomenon. Religion is at the heart of it. But all these other elements must somehow feed in order for the liveliness and the tum, the very special flavor of Judaism, to emerge and to be attractive to the oncoming generations. Now, these ideas were attractive to many, and they were attractive to the leadership of this congregation. When our grandfathers were determining on building what was then to be the new temple, the Ansel Road building, the main temple, during the late 19-teens and the early 1920s, they were very much attracted to an institutional idea which Mordecai Kaplan had pioneered in New York a dozen years before. He was serving at that time as the rabbi of a rather traditional synagogue, and when that synagogue moved uptown to Yorktown, he importuned the leadership of the synagogue by suggesting to them that they ought to become what he called a synagogue center. That is, that they ought to branch out from the synagogue as it had been established in America, which was essentially the synagogue of Eastern Europe, that is, the synagogue as a place of worship and a place of occasional study. And they ought to recognize that in America, the synagogue had to perform almost all of the had to house almost all of the activities which were normally part of the wharf and the woof of an Eastern European Jewish community. In Eastern Europe, the little community he'd come from, 80-90% of the people were Jews. They spoke a Jewish language, Yiddish. They went to theater and saw a Yiddish play. They read Shalom Aleichem, they read Peretz, they read Mendel and Mocher Sefarim. The music that they sang was either liturgical or folk music, but it was Jewish music. Judaism was in the air they breathed, in the food that they ate, in the culture which formed them. And since in America we live in a pluralistic society, and since outside of the Jewish world there was something which was different, not necessarily evil, but different, Kaplan insisted that the synagogue must somehow take the place of the community, and it must provide under its roof all of these activities. And so he, in the Jewish Center, which he pioneered in Yorktown in New York, he created an institution where there were lectures, discussions, public discussions of Jewish issues, Jewish singers, Jewish actors, Yiddish theater, Yiddish was spoken as well as English. A whole variety of activities were attempted and inaugurated, and this model was an attractive one. So much so that when the people who came together to build the main temple decided to build it, they took that model of the temple center. And those of you who remember the building before it was renovated in the mid-1950s may remember that the social hall, which was then called Mahler Hall, had a large skylighted roof, and it also had a stage. The stage was for theater. The skylighted roof was to allow basketball games inside of the hall. And if you go up the steps to the little area, which very few people ever see, an area which we now use to house the Abba Hillel Silver Archives, you'll find in there a series of shower stalls where the youngsters could change after their games. And the museum, well, the museum was to be a swimming pool. It was never finished as such, fortunately, but it was to be that. And if you look in the bulletins of the 1920s, you'll find that there was a determined effort to house within the walls of the temple a variety of activities, cultural, scholarly, theatrical, literary, which would express the whole range of interests which go into the making up of Jewish life. Now, interestingly, in 1929, what we would call today a long-range planning committee met. And that planning committee looked over the past 8 years that were built where the temple's program was designed in essentially as an emulation of Kaplan's ideas, and they came to the conclusion that they were a failure. And since, in a strange way, some of the realities of Jewish life did not change, some of the pressures on congregations remain the same, I'd like to read to you from their report, dated May of 1929, as to why this attempt to make the synagogue a kolbo, something in which all things that make up Jewish culture did not work. They wrote, "The Temple Center has now been in existence long enough to enable us to take stock of its contribution to the life of the synagogue. In fact, such surveys have been made. The findings have not at all justified the early enthusiastic claims which were made for the Temple Center. One, in the larger congregations, the center does not seem to attract the members of the Temple families. It appeals largely to the unaffiliated Jews of the community, principally those within the immediate vicinity of the Temple. While this in itself is not undesirable, the fact remains that the Temple Center is not a Temple Center, but a neighborhood settlement. It does not serve the families which are affiliated with the Temple, and who should be the primary concern of the congregation. Two, many of the members of liberal congregations belong to social clubs of their own, and the Temple as a center cannot compete with these clubs in the realm of entertainment and recreation. At best, it can urge upon them additional social activities for which they have no need. Three, the crowding of many secular activities in the life of a congregation frequently causes men to lose sight of the real purposes of a religious institution. The voice of the synagogue is drowned out in the midst of the tumult and the noise of many activities which we carried on as well, if not better, elsewhere. Four, the hope that young people would be attracted to worship and religious study through the magnetism of dances, plays, athletics, and parties has not been realized. Young people are in the habit of selecting the things for which they care most. If they're interested in entertainments, they will come to them. If they are not interested in the services, the sermon, and the study group, they will attend these. The appeal of the synagogue is not heightened through the bait of amusements. Five, it has not been found possible successfully to transform the large congregation into a congregational clubhouse wherein all ages and groups will meet for their social intercourse. Our larger metropolitan temples no longer represent homogeneous social groups. Rather, they reflect all the social strata in a community. While these elements will meet in religious services, in the religious school, and other educational activities, it has been found extremely difficult to have them meet in purely social gatherings. As a result, most of these social gatherings in the larger temples are attended by representatives of only one or two groups within the congregation, and not at all by the entire congregational family. This has a tendency to emphasize distinctions and separateness within a congregation rather than the hoped-for fellowship. Six, the time, money, and energy expended in carrying out an extensive center program are inordinately great and are a heavy tax upon the rabbis of a congregation. Many temples have sought to solve their problem by engaging the services of a director of temple activities. Such an office, however, does not absolve the rabbis of all responsibility for the activities which go on, and he is constrained to devote much time and thought to them, thought and time which should be devoted to specific religious functions and to his studies. In many congregations, the rabbi has been forced to become a practical manager instead of a religious guide and teacher. These considerations and others lead us to the conclusion that the temple should in the future devote itself largely to the role which it alone can perform in a community, namely as a house of prayer and a house of religious study. Now, the program of the Temple Center, which had been envisioned by Kaplan, was abandoned here in 1929. In part, though it's not said in this document, because there were other elements in the community which had begun to develop and to pick up the kinds of cultural activities which the congregations could not deliver from their own specific perspective. Because in the long run, though the experiment with a congregational center was not a particularly effective one, the concept of Judaism as a civilization, which incidentally is the title of Dr. Kaplan's most important book, is one which has merit. Judaism is something more than a catechism. It's something more than a set of dogmas about man and God and duty and responsibility. We use the word, it's a way of life. A sociologist as well as a philosopher and theologian, Kaplan preferred the word culture or the word civilization. And he insisted that it was only by intensifying those elements which go to make up a religious culture, the cultural as well as the religious, the Jewish life could have the depth, the many dimensions, the subtlety, the appeal that it would require if it was to survive in these United States. And throughout his long life, he tried to reconstruct Jewish life, its institutions and its thought, in order to make it possible for Judaism to emerge from a medieval model and from an early modern model into one which he thought was appropriate to modern times. And to that extent, he was reflecting on and responding to the problem that all serious Jews reflected on and responded to in his day and even to our day. What it is that goes into making a Jewish identity? What is it that a Jewish community must provide by way of experiences, binding experiences, which will allow, which will entice, which will intrigue the next generation to make it, to become part of our community and of our future? And clearly these elements include the elements of culture and of civilization, as well as the religious elements of which Kaplan spoke. Now, when Kaplan moved from institutional reconstruction to this concern for the intensifying the religious civilization, he might have moved in the direction of re-ghettoizing American Jewish life. One way in which one can intensify the ethos is by turning a Jew inward, away from the media, away from the larger world. That was not his way. In many ways, Kaplan was simply speaking the language which Reform had spoken 30, 40 years before, but to a new generation coming out of a new background. He was intrigued by the thought of the 19th and 20th century. He believed that Judaism was an organic, developing communion. He believed that the Torah had been developed over time. It was not a single item given to Moses on Mount Sinai. He believed that really in a doctrine of progress that was typical of many of the philosophers and thinkers of the 19th century. He read Locke, and he read Jefferson, and he read Lincoln, and he read Wilson. He was very much moved by cultural pluralism. He was a man who insisted that far from turning within, Judaism must intensify its culture because America would thrive if cultural pluralism was in fact that. That is, if each culture was rich and each community was willing to mix democratically with those of other communities, therefore rubbing elbows, sharing ideas, offering its own culture to be seen and to be enjoyed, and therefore enhancing the sum total of the American ethos. As a matter of fact, one of the themes that Kaplan struck again and again in his thinking was the fact that Jews, too, must give up ideas of superiority and of innate differences. Of all the ideas of the past with which he was most angry, the idea of the chosen people was the one which gave him the most problems. And in his own prayer book of the Reconstructionist Movement, he took out all those phrases which said, Asher Bachar Ban, who has chosen us. The concepts of election and of the chosenness were removed in order that Jews should recognize that the Jewish way, the Jewish religious civilization, was only one of a number of ways in which man, in different conditions, in different situations, historical and cultural, responded to the will of God, responded to the need to create civilization. As a sociologist, Kaplan introduced many important concepts into our thinking. As a theologian, he was really more of an eclectic who spoke for the generation of which he was a part, but did not really take them beyond the confusions and the uncertainties and doubts. Indeed, he tended to consecrate these. His generation, the bright young men, came to America with a far more intensive Jewish cultural background than the generation which had preceded them. And they moved out to CCNY, and they moved out to NYU, and they moved into the strata of the intellectual life of our country and of New York. And they had doubts about the personality of God. They had doubts about revelation. They had doubts about the meaningfulness of prayer. They had doubts about about miracles and about many of the old forms of the religious tradition. But they were Jews. They ate the Jewish foods, they breathed the Jewish air. Their Jewishness took more colorful, intensive forms than the Jewishness of the Reformed Jews who had been there in the generation previous. But in many ways, they were more radical in their suspicions of the traditional religious forms. And Kaplan spoke to these people by insisting that Judaism should be seen as a way of life. The rituals of Jewish life should be seen as cultural folkways. The religious experience was one of congregation, of coming together, of living for a moment in a Jewish environment. He tended to downplay the idea of worship as a form of petition to God. Worship was a form of living a Jewish life for a Jewish hour among Jews, confronting the Jewish tradition as it had come down over time. God himself he defined in a radically new way. He took away from God the sense of personality, the sense that there's some place, someone up there, as many of the medievals had, a great sugar daddy in heaven protecting us. And God was, for Kaplan, simply the sum total of all of those forces which are somehow out there in life, which speak to us of our moral duties and responsibilities. And like so many who came out of the poverty and out of the simplicities of Eastern European life, he was a social visionary committed to social change and to the development of a more equitable social order. And so he spoke of the mystery which is beyond as being essentially ethical in its compelling quality. There's a moral purpose to the universe, and that moral purpose reaches out to us from beyond the world of appearances, and the sum total of that outreaching represented to him what he meant by the term God. And here I think I come, at least, to my greatest problem with Heschel's writings. Because God is not, if there is the mystery, there is that sense of the numinous which lies beyond the obvious. But can we say in this world which has seen Auschwitz, can we see in this world which has endured the fascism and Stalin and Nazism and the atomization of cities, can we any longer speak of that mysterious beyond as simply moral in its higher purpose? I began with the book of Job, and I want to end with the book of Job. There are two visions of God in Job. They're not resolved. We really can't. One is the vision of Kaplan. It's a vision which sees God as morality, as ethics, as the quintessence of goodness of all that we hope for and pray for. In one of the speeches early in Job, the comforters say, "For my part, I would make my petition to God and lay my cause before him, who does great and unsearchable things, marvels without number. He gives rain to the earth and sends waters on the field. He raises the lowly to the heights. The mourners are uplifted by victory. He frustrates the plots of the crafty, and they win no success. He traps the cunning in their craftiness, and the schemer's plans are thrown into confusion. In the daylight, they run into darkness and grope by midday as though it were night. He saves the destitute from their greed and the needy from the grip of the strong. So the poor hope again and the unjust are sickened." God is the moral will within the universe, that which makes all things come out right. And Job, of course, who has had the shattering experience of recognizing that all things do not come out right, presents a vision of God, of the mystery beyond which is not simply benevolent, but at times almost malevolent in its power. World, the mystery which is not the kindly grandfather sitting in heaven waving the wand when we need the wand waved for us, but is a power beyond whose justice we hope we can affirm, but we cannot fully describe in our lives. Job says this: "In God's hands are the souls of all that live, the spirits of all humankind. Wisdom and might are his, with him are firmness and understanding. If he pulls down, there is no rebuilding. If he imprisons, there is no release. If he holds up the waters, there is drought. If he lets them go, they turn the land upside down. Strength and success belong to him. Deceived and deceiver are his to use. He makes counselors behave like idiots and drives judges mad. He looses the bonds imposed by kings and removes the girdle of office from their waists. He makes priests behave like idiots and overthrows men long in office. Those who are trusted, he strikes dumb. He takes away the judgment of old men. He heaps scorn on princes and abates the arrogance of nobles. He leads people astray and destroys them. He lays them low, and there they lie. He takes away their wisdom from the rulers of the nations and leaves them wandering in a pathless wilderness. They grope in the darkness without light and are left to wander like a drunkard. He uncovers mysteries deep in obscurity, and into thick darkness he brings light." There is some hope, for it's also the recognition of a power which is uncertain in the way it intrudes into human life, often upsetting our most fervent prayers and hopes and aspirations. Kaplan was a child of his age, really a child of the 19th century. an optimistic time, a time that believed in democracy and progress, that all things would work out, that there was a moral purpose to the universe which, if we responded to it, would lead to the unfolding of the potential of the human spirit. He believed that we could, in a society such as ours, in all societies, come to the time when men of goodwill, with understanding and responding to God, link hands and work together for the common good. He believed that Jewish life, centered in Israel, centered in the intensity of its culture, could be one of the ways by which men and women could come to understand their moral duty and begin to live a truly sensitive and empathetic life. It's a great hope. It's a great vision. He simplified that vision for a generation which was awake, which had awakened to the contradictions in modern thought, and had certainly become quite aware of the limitations of medieval Jewish thought. He allowed them to participate wholly in nostalgia, in the folkways, in the activity which makes for Jewish culture. But when all is said and done, he never resolved the problem of how to live in the world which has known Auschwitz. How to live in a world which must come to grips with the truth of radical evil, which must come to grips with a God who is something more than simply the power that makes for righteousness, and where man is something less than a potentially divine being whose decencies will simply unfold as a new culture allows him greater freedom, greater calm, greater peace, and greater love. Kaplan was a man of great significance in his generation and to the people who shared his experience. He spoke for them and he spoke to them. But I think when the 20th century is written, he will be a man who will be judged to have had more significance in his own generation than he will have to the generations yet to come. Because he speaks of a time before our time. He speaks a truth, a very important truth, about Judaism and its very nature, that we are not simply a religious communion or catechism. We're not simply a set of beliefs. We are a rich culture, and we can express the truths and the insights and the understandings of our people only if we create the communities which express the wholeness of that culture. In that, there can be no argument. But to have that simple kind of faith in human decency and God's benevolence in our age is, at least for this rabbi, an impossible one. His sense of the complexity of life and of the needs to adjust to modernity have deserted him. And he speaks to an older and simpler time. Alavai. But it's not so. Amen.